Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink and Abigail Walls. A little later, Mark Schauer will be joining us, former congressman, former nominee for the Democrats for governor in 2014. But first, we are on the heels of Donald Trump's appearance in Diamonddale over the weekend, guys. And the question that seems to come up, particularly on the conservative talk show rackets, is the media biased against Donald Trump? Let's get your opinion, John. Yes? No?
Are the leaves on the trees green? Yes, I think it's pretty biased against Donald Trump. And you don't need to take my word for it. If you wait 3 or 4 months after the election, you can read the Columbia School of Journalism Review, and they'll probably tally it all up and show the bias that was there.
Why is that? You agree with this, right, Abby?
Yeah, I certainly think that there's a level of bias against Trump. I think it's some amalgamation of the things that he says and the sort of reputation that he's built for himself. And
sort of earned bias.
Yeah.
Well, I think also, though, he makes it easy for the media in that what he says is so easy to understand. You know what I mean? I mean, so often, I think, particularly the national media is like lightning, right? It strikes at like the easiest spot that it can land on. And when you've got somebody who's bombastic and says things that are so unusual for a presidential candidate, I mean, you just kind of naturally glom onto it. So I don't know if it's necessarily that they don't want Trump to be elected. I mean, I'm going to give the media at all kind of the benefit of the doubt. But I do think that he makes it easy for them by saying bombastic things that make things easy to cover.
My question here, though, is how can at once the media be responsible for the rise of Trump and biased against him at the same time?
If you read the New York Times, for example, I mean, there's the inclusion of certain words that don't need to necessarily be included. I'll give you a good example. Right before the beginning of the Republican convention, I was reading coverage of a shooting in the South, and it really had nothing to do with the convention in Cleveland. But yet, the third paragraph noted that the shooting occurred as tensions rise 2 days before Republicans gathered in Cleveland. There was no violence in Cleveland. There was a presupposition that this convention was going to bring about violence and insurrection and protests that never happened. It was like they went into the article, you know, expecting that this, in part, was tied somehow to the Republican convention. I mean, it's not.
But when you have a presidential candidate who is supplying stuff that will, you know, fuel the media, the mill, what do you expect, right? I mean, he's creating the exact publicity that he deserves, really. I mean, if you say it, that's what you're going to get, which I think is different from Hillary Clinton, who is basically saying nothing to the media, so she is getting unoffensive news coverage. And I think that's actually more disturbing than whatever the media seems to be doing on Donald Trump. I would say the bigger problem here is that the media is not holding Hillary Clinton accountable for actually talking to the media in any kind of organized way outside of...
Isn't that therein bias?
How so? Well, bias in the fact that they're giving her a free pass here?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if it's bias or not. Maybe they're just... They've become sedentary on the whole thing, right? They've become comfortable with, you know, their free meals and the traveling press, and they get their little nuggets of information tossed here or there and made to feel really special. When in the end, when you really think about what they have, what do they have but not the candidate? They have almost everything else except her. What does she really think, you know, as opposed to something filtered, you know, from carefully filtered, I would add, from this advisor or this consultant? I think that's really the most disturbing thing about this presidential election, particularly since Hillary Clinton is going to be president, and this will represent now the second straight president who doesn't talk to the media, like in any kind of organized way.
I think with Trump, too, I think that's a great point, Kyle, but there's a level of, like, fascination that is reflective of what American readers are looking for as well. Like, I opened up Washington Post Wonk blog today, 5 stories deep about Donald Trump, all sort of picking at what's his strategy, what's his, you know, what's he getting at. I think there's sort of like a collective fascination with this candidate that leads up the garden path to bias.
I see what you're saying, because he doesn't seem to have a traditional strategy. And if, and there's all these theories about he's got a strategy, but it's so brilliant that we haven't figured it out yet. And everybody wants to be the first one to really crack the code, right?
I think, yeah. And, you know, and the Clintons have been around, you know, since the 90s. I mean, what else is there, I think, is kind of the attitude.
It's blue blood politics. We've kind of been there, done that. And it's almost like a yawn fest, I suppose, right?
I suppose, yes.
You're kind of grinning, though, here, John. Well, I mean, how do you think the media's done in covering Hillary Clinton? Do you think they've been fair in covering her, or have they given her a pass?
I think, to a degree, they've given her a pass. You know, I don't necessarily blame her. I think she's actually exercising good judgment and strategy by not necessarily making herself available. I mean, Donald Trump, as I mentioned, this is earned bias. I mean, he's making his own mistakes. He's creating his own white spotlight, and she's smart in kind of letting him hang himself. That's why I'm grinning, because it's just, you know.
At what point, though, and maybe there doesn't become a point, maybe the press just accepts that presidential nominees just aren't supposed to be talked to, you know? I mean, gone are the days when the traveling press is on an airplane and you get to have a few minutes with Gerald Ford, or you get a few minutes with George W. Bush, or whoever, or Jimmy Carter, whoever it's going to be. You know, now you're lucky if you're even on the same plane as Hillary Clinton. Now they've got their own separate deal, right? You're not even in the same airspace as the presidential nominee.
You know, but look, part of the problem that I have this election cycle is, you know, and I read the New York Times, I read the Wall Street Journal. It's not like I don't read newspapers, but there's so much a focus on half-completed sentences and what they might or might not have meant that we're not even. I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw an in-depth look at, here's a side-by-side comparison of their economic plans. Here's a side-by-side comparison of their tax plan. I mean, that's just not even really happening yet. And maybe it's just too early, but
the coverage even
is so thin. It's
but,
so
but maybe the tax plans are thin.
I would say neither of them even has a plan. I mean, I remember in Detroit, April, I think, I listened to Hillary Clinton's big reveal on what she was going to do for manufacturers. And it was nothing that would shatter the earth. It was the Democratic platform on trade. It was the Democratic platform on jobs and family paid leave. I mean, how do you compare these candidates when they're not really repeating anything new?
When the plans almost kind of seem like the run-of-the-mill kind of stuff, like Donald Trump, all right, cut taxes and we're going to cut regulation and let business expand and, you know, let things roll, right?
I mean, battle of the platitudes.
While as the Democrats, it's let's throw more spending on to various public programs and you know, let's build the infrastructure and go from
there.
I'd
rather see a greater exploration of the platitudes than a further exploration of half-completed sentences and what they might or might not mean.
But isn't that a reflection of our attention span, though, John? I mean, it's like we'll read a few sentences out of an article. I mean, when's the last time you actually made it through an entire article and thought, wow, that was something else? You know, it's like we're reading snippets from the Daily Beast or something.
Just this morning when I finished my MERS newsletter, I thought, wow, that was great.
Yeah, from beginning to end, right?
From beginning to end.
Yeah.
Renew your subscriptions, folks.
But really, I think I just read a Time magazine article on who is Hillary Clinton. And that took me, four or five sittings? I'm not saying that was an in-depth article, but I think just as a society, we're just all interrupted all the time. Our minds are going all over the place. It's like we all got ADD and we just can't focus on anything at all. And so when Trump says something bombastic and strange, it's just so easy to just pick it out of the air and super analyze it and be the smartest person in the room to determine what he said and what he meant and what a fool the guy really is.
I think they call that shiny object syndrome.
Yes.
And we all kind of have it, don't we?
My family, we called it squirrel.
Squirrel! Well, in some degree or the other, I guess we're all kind of guilty of it. The people who consume the product, the people who are making the product, which is us, I guess all we can do is try our best, right? Do we feed the public's ADD, or do we just kind of feed into it because that's what they want? Deep thoughts of the day. Okay, we'll let the audience kind of stew on that a bit, and we'll give them something else to chew on here with Mark Schauer. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
It's my pleasure.
Good to see you again. So tell our listeners what you've been doing.
Oh, what have I been doing besides chasing around grandkids, which has been fun.
Wondered why you're so trim.
that's certainly part of it. From a work standpoint, most of my work has been working on a Democratic Party national redistricting project to end Republican gerrymandering of the states and of Congress. So that's sort of what I wake up in the morning thinking about. So I do some consulting on a couple of other business projects. Actually, working as part of a group on an entrepreneurial venture in Michigan. Very exciting. So,
like a private sector kind of thing?
Okay. Yeah, very much so. So it's been fun to kind of work on the private sector side in addition to continuing to stay involved in Democratic politics and public service. I mean, you know, that's obviously my passion, and do my part to undo a lot of the damage that's been done in the states and nationally by a Republican Party that's moved very far to the right. So Michigan is kind of a poster child of that in many ways.
Well, talking about the redistricting, we'll start there. Yeah. This redistricting project, do you see a possibility of some type of ballot proposal in 18 or 2020 to change how we redistrict here in Michigan, or does it really depend on what the Democrats do here in 16?
Yes, it could depend on what happens in 16. And by the way, from a national perspective, in only about half the states do voters have the ability to go to the ballot to either initiate a law or amend their constitution to create an independent redistricting commission, a la Arizona, probably the most famous one because that's where, you know, the Supreme Court case last year. Michigan is one of those states where voters have that opportunity. But, you know, from my standpoint, I can't assume that will happen. And so the way district lines are drawn for the legislature and in Congress, and I've experienced it at least one time when I was in the legislature, experienced the effects of it after I left Congress, and they drew me out of my own congressional district. But it's done as a political process. It's done legislatively. There are bills that are introduced, and you know, I've seen, had them on my desk. They're very thick, but it's a legislative slash political process. So Republicans have controlled everything the last couple of rounds of redistricting, and we've got the districts and candidly the policies to show for it. So what my immediate goal is to help the Michigan House win back a majority by 2020. Candidly, I think there's an excellent chance that they'll do that in 2016, and then they'd have to hold it in a midterm year with those are always tougher for Democrats and will be because I expect there'll be a Democratic president. So it's usually tougher for the party in power. But then again, make sure when the dust settles on the 2020 election, Democrats at least have control of part of that redistricting pen. I mean, the Senate, you know, is only up in 18. The governor's race will be very important to that process in 2018. And then, of course, the Supreme Court could have a say if there's an impasse. But to your question, I think it still is an independent question whether there will be or should be an effort to create an independent redistricting commission in Michigan. I know there was an effort to do that that didn't ultimately turn into collecting signatures for 2016. So it may very well happen.
There's a key question that always comes up when I talk about this with folks is, independent commission, how do you define it? How do you create it? How do you really ensure that it's truly independent?
Sure.
I mean, as you know, things can shift.
Yeah.
Depending on
well,
where the point
I credit Rep. John Hoadley. I know he's been one of the leaders. Steve Bita, I think, on the Senate side has also been working on this. You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There is best practice that exists, whether it's California, Arizona. Iowa has an interesting model where they use sort of their equivalent of the Legislative Services Bureau to draw nonpartisan maps, and the legislature has the ability to reject those and send them back to be redone, but that's another way that it can be done. Typically, what states do is they have voters create these things, have very clear requirements as to who can be a part of the commission. I mean, we have voter files, or you can go to a private vendor like a Mark Grebner or somebody to determine someone's partisan background. point is, you find people who have no partisan background. They haven't given to partisan candidates. They haven't identified as a partisan, and so there are ways to do it. It's not an impossible task, and so I think we don't have to start from zero for sure. If that's the approach that groups decide to take here in Michigan.
Give us your impressions on what you make of this presidential race. John noted your Hillary Clinton bumper sticker. It should be no surprise, obviously, you're supporting Hillary Clinton. But what's your perceptions on Trump and what he's been doing?
Yeah, I think his campaign has been a disaster. I think it's embarrassing. And I think he will be a colossal failure. And the Republican Party will have to pick up the pieces and figure out where to go from there. I want to see a strong, healthy two-party system here. I think that's creates checks and balances, and ultimately it, I think, gives everyone a say. But Donald Trump, I don't think he is a Republican. I mean, I don't know clearly what he is, but his brand of attack politics, of attacking and alienating groups, of sort of isolationism, nativism, racism, sexism, and more is, you know, may serve him well with a narrow slice of the electorate. And narrow, you know, it could be 35-40% of the electorate, sadly. But he doesn't have the ability to really grow and attract other portions of the electorate. In fact, as polling is showing around the country, even in dark red states, he's losing segments of the electorate, whether it's Republican women or educated white voters. I mean, when you look at how he's performing with those slices of the electorate versus Mitt Romney 4 years ago, I mean, he is underwater. And so I think this will be a landslide electoral college win for Hillary Clinton and a disaster for Donald Trump and those who support him and his party. You know, you look at the division within the Republican Party, again, that's a troubling, troubling sign. And Bill Milliken, you know, just sort of a saint in Michigan politics, one of the most revered people that I can think of supporting Hillary Clinton and then being attacked by Republicans and others coming to his defense. I mean, I talked to my friend Joe Schwartz, and we've worked very closely together over the years. He's supporting Hillary Clinton, and so there are many others like that just can't stomach Donald Trump. So I think, you know, we have to work for it, and the good news is I see it on the west side of the state and in, you know, my hometown of Battle Creek, a robust Clinton ground game. I talked to Hillary's Michigan political director early this morning. You know, they're not taking anything for granted, and they're running, you know, and from my sort of national redistricting role, this is very encouraging, running a 50-state strategy. So Hillary understands the important on down-ballot races, and that's another reason why I think House Democrats in 2016 will do well.
Do you think she'll pay some visits between now and the election to, say, Macomb and maybe the northern Michigan, the areas where Trump looks like he might be the strongest?
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I mean, it was significant that she was in Macomb County recently. I certainly hope so. Politics and elections aside, knows how significant Michigan is, how significant Michigan is to manufacturing in our country, how significant the auto industry is, how significant the labor movement is here in Michigan and its impact and importance nationally. So I don't have that knowledge, but I hope so. She's got, a 50-state strategy, and she's got a solid at least 10-point lead here in Michigan. And, you know, I'm going to respect the strategic decisions that she and her team make.
Now, you mentioned the ground game. You've been in your old House district and campaigning with Artsma, who's running against John Bison.
Yeah.
Give us some word from the field. What are you hearing from the voters down in that neck of the woods?
It is my old House district. It's changed a bit, but its core is still the same. Certainly, I represented all of it in the state Senate and in Congress. You know, I would describe that John Bison is not well-known. He is a first-termer. I've not seen any evidence that they're knocking on doors. I mean, you get a feeling. I've knocked on a fair number of doors. Actually, I was out yesterday. I'm going to be back out this afternoon, you see evidence. You know, I haven't picked up a piece of bison literature at any door. It's not, you know, look, we still have a ways to go. That may change. But Jim Hodgma is the hardest working candidate you will find. And he is ubiquitous. He is well known, and he's well liked, as seen as someone who truly cares about people, who is a champion for all people. You know, he's got a very, very good campaign, and you know, the Hillary campaign and the Hodgma campaign are working together out of the same headquarters, along with coordinated countywide campaign, which, by the way, includes my wife, Christine Schauer, who's running for re-election as Calhoun County Treasurer and is doing an incredible job and has a great record to stand on. But we're all working together, and the strong top of the ticket, and by the way, it looks like straight ticket voting will stand, which is just one more thing that helps Democrats. And, you know, it was just pure politics why the Republican legislature in Snyder tried to do away. Thank God for the courts and thoughtful judges. But I think we've got a lot of things going for us. And it feels a lot like 20 years ago when I took on Eric Bush, first term Republican incumbent. Presidential year, we had a great field campaign, just pounded the doors, was everywhere, just like Jim Hodgma is. And, you know, the polling didn't look good, but we ended up, you know, winning by 10 points. And so it feels reminiscent of 1996 to me.
Last thing we want to touch on, obviously you've seen the headlines over this past year here regarding Flint. Do you wake up thinking, thank God I didn't win that gubernatorial election?
No, actually quite the opposite. I wish I were governor because the scenario would have been very different. Clearly I would have inherited that situation. I mean, it was Rick Snyder's emergency manager that made the decision. It was Rick Snyder's treasurer who signed the changeover to the Flint River. The way I've described it to people, and I've not talked about this a lot publicly because, you know, I don't have a political axe to grind. I just know it would be different. I mean, when the best comparison I can make is when the Enbridge oil spill happened in my district, and I had just landed in Washington to start the week in Congress, learned about it. The next morning had a meeting with the president, with another group of freshmen congressmen, told the president about it. He pledged his assistance. The next morning jumped on a plane and was on the ground at like 6 a.m. at the site of the river. And when we held EPA, Enbridge, the Federal Pipeline Safety Regulatory Agency, all accountable in that process, what I can tell you is the first indication I would have had of a family in Flint concerned about their water, holding up a bottle of brown water, I would have been in their living room. And to see the sort of, you know, laissez-faire attitude of this administration, and including Attorney General Schuette's office, who had complaints from citizens from Flint, and emails, you know, and this is why we need strong FOIA laws subjecting the governor and the executive office and the legislature to the Freedom of Information Act. Clearly, they were covering it up, but also blaming complaints on people who had a political axe to grind. I mean, people have been hurt, children irreparably damaged as a result of lead poisoning, and this administration took a laissez-faire attitude. I would have taken a very aggressive approach, and probably one of the first things is to stop Flint River water being the water source for the city, and gone back to Detroit water immediately, and I would have worked to ameliorate the damage right away. So I wish I were there rather than an administration that is candidly been asleep at the switch and been in some cases negligent in dealing with the situation that they created.
All right, Mark Schauer, former congressman and state senator, state house member, and gubernatorial nominee. Shoot, I almost need a whole podcast to run down your resume. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be back, Kyle and John. Thank you.